Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the May 2012 Home Education Conference held in Fredericksburg, Virginia.
It's been said that the reason that a lot of our fairy tales have endured for so long is because they're simply a kernel of truth with a story wrapped around it. And I'm afraid I missed that kernel of truth in Sleeping Beauty almost my whole life. I was watching Walt Disney's version fairly recently with some of my granddaughters when it finally hit me what the story was about. In the movie, Beauty has gone to sleep. And when Beauty fell asleep, all the kingdom became colorless and lifeless. And then noxious briars and tangled vines and weeds grew up around the kingdom. And then along came Prince Philip. And he drew his sword of truth and his shield of righteousness. It really says that in Walt Disney. He drew his sword of truth and his shield of righteousness to fight his way through the tangled mess. But that wasn't what brought the kingdom back to life. The thing that brought the kingdom back to life was his love of Beauty. When Beauty received true love's first kiss, then Beauty awoke and all the kingdom gloriously sprang back to life. Beauty in a large measure has gone to sleep in our world. 100 years ago, educators were extremely concerned about instilling a love of beauty in our children. But today, as we talk about the problems of education, when was the last time you heard someone say, "How are we going to get our kids to love beauty?" I haven't heard that fairly recently. Why does beauty matter? Let me try and explain why I think in this experience that I had. I've painted exactly one painting in my life that hangs in my living room. I went to a three-day workshop given by a gifted artist, John McNaughton. And before I went to this workshop, I'd never even picked up a paintbrush before, but I went with my son, who is artistic. I've never considered myself artistic at all. From the very first, John assured us that on the third day, we were going to work magic. So trusting in him, but doubting in myself, I selected a country scene at sunset. And he unfolded to us how to do this painting step by step, and the painting layered up. Until the end of the second day, I looked and all I had was this mess of raw umber staring at me. And I was so embarrassed of it, I probably wouldn't have gone back for the third day except that my son was there and I went with him. But John kept assuring us, don't give up. Magic is about to happen on the third day. I was so glad I went back because he was right. On the third day, he taught us about jewels. Jewels were made by mixing white paint with different colors, and then you would apply them in different places on the painting. And when that happened, it's like the painting came to life. All of a sudden, I found myself strolling on this little dirt path in this country lane among the lilacs and the iris and the forget-me-nots, and I could feel the summer breezes and I could feel the warm glow of the sunset on the cottage. And I couldn't stop looking at the painting because of the way it made me feel. I was humbled that I could create this piece of art when I had so little ability, but it all had to do with the jewels. A love of beauty provides the jewels of life. Beauty is synonymous with truth and light, and its effect is pure joy, a joy that is completely independent from outward circumstances. Viktor Frankl observed a small group of prisoners in those horrible death camps of Nazi Germany who secretly gathered every night to recite poetry, sing songs, and act in plays, even though these were forbidden and punishable by death. He even watched them give up their meager meals after grueling hard days of work just for the chance to participate in these jewels. Art and beauty became the soul's weapon in the fight for self-preservation. The life-sustaining power of beauty is found in its ability to inspire. To inspire implies filling with spirit or light. Dr. David Hawkins explains, the term spirit refers to an unseen essence. This essence is vital. When we lose our spirit, we die. We expire from lack of that which inspires. When an individual or nation lacks in beauty and those qualities that we turn inspiration, he becomes devoid of humanity and self-respect and love, and selfishness and violence fills in the void. I watched this principle of beauty in action in the life of a man that my husband and I came to know at a senior retirement center. Grant was well in his 90s, and we went on Sundays to help with the church services. And we would watch Grant shuffle in with this little Edna on his arms. I don't think Edna even reached 5 feet tall, and Grant was a very frail-looking man with stooped shoulders. We'd watch him seat Edna down, and then out of one pocket, he'd pull a comb, and he would comb Edna's hair. And then in the other pocket, he would reach in for a couple of little bows that he would just carefully place in her hair. And then he'd lick his fingers and lay the hairs down so that they would lay flat. Grant had every reason to despair. Their only daughter had died when she was a young woman. And Edna had suffered the effects of Alzheimer's. It had been years since she had even recognized Grant and rarely spoke any words. He was her primary caretaker, and they lived in an independent living apartment. But he held a treasure of jewels in his heart. From the time he was a child, he memorized poetry that throughout his life he kept refreshed and alive. And we would often call on him to recite something, and when he would stand, all of a sudden his eyes would light up and his voice would become very strong and vibrant as he would recite this beautiful poetry. One night my husband and I went to his apartment, and he said that he was just so very, very tired. And I said, Grant, do you have a poem for us? And his eyes lit up, and away he went. Wink and blink and a nod one night, sailed off in a wooden shoe, sailed in a river of crystal light into a sea of dew. Where are you going, and what do you wish? The old man asked of the three. We're off to fish for the herring fish that live in the beautiful sea. Nets of silver and gold have we, said Wink and Blink and a nod. And he went on to recite, I think there's 4 or 5 verses. And I said, Grant, is this a poem that you carried over from your childhood? And he said, oh no, this is what I've been working on the last several weeks. This is how a lonely, tired man kept his heart from failing. This was his jewel of life that gave him joy in times of sorrow. So shut your eyes while Mother sings of wonderful sights that be, and you shall see the beautiful things as you rock in the misty sea. He passed away just a few days later, and Edna followed shortly thereafter, but I will be forever grateful to what he taught me about the power of poetry in giving us jewels at a time of a difficult time. As Latter-day Saints, we look forward to a time when there will be a great transformation of the earth, when it will be returned to a paradisiacal glory, and peace will be found for 1,000 years. People of many faiths share this same belief, but before it happens, the earth is going to have to pass through a dark and cold winter. We can see the storm clouds gathering. The times will be challenging, and only those who can still see the stars in the middle of the dark night sky will be and can be guided by them will be the ones that will be able to make it through that. The scriptures talk of a group of people who will come to Zion singing songs. Over and over it talks about them singing songs. And it may be a literal meaning, but I think it is more descriptive of a people whose hearts are so full of joy that the outward circumstances aren't getting them down, that they find joy in the middle of the sorrow. These are the ones whose hearts will not fail them. You are the mothers and the guardians of a marked and chosen generation, and it is your privilege to awaken a love of beauty in the hearts of your children in preparation for this glorious time. And it is my hope that I can share a few ideas of how we can do this. We're surrounded by beauty. What is lacking are eyes to see it. Helen Keller, who could neither see nor hear, teaches us a lot about seeing. One day she had a friend who had just come in from a long walk in the woods, and Helen asked her, so what did you see? And the friends said, "Oh, nothing in particular." And Helen exclaimed, "I would have been incredulous had I not become accustomed to such responses, for long ago I concluded that the seeing see little. How is it possible, I asked myself, to spend an entire hour in the woods and see nothing worthy of note? I who cannot see find hundreds of things to give me pleasure through mere touch. I feel the delicate symmetry of a leaf. I rub my hands lovingly over the smooth silk of a silver birch or the rough shaggy bark of a pine. I can feel the velvety texture of a flower, and something of the mystery of nature is revealed to me. At times, I cry out with longing to see all these things. If I can get so much pleasure from mere touch, how much more beauty must be revealed by sight? And yet, apparently, those with eyes see little. The panorama of color and action which fills this world is taken for granted. It is human, perhaps, to long for that which we have not, and to take for granted that which we have. But it is a pity that in the world of light, the gift of sight is used as a mere convenience rather than as a means of adding fullness to life. Nature is, there's Helen Keller, I forgot to give you your picture. Nature is God's university. It is pure truth. From nature we learn that spring always follows winters, that we reap what we sow, that some things just take time. But if our children are to pick up those lessons, we need to first help them see with their hearts, and engaging the heart and awakening feeling is the job of story. I live out in the middle of the countryside here in Virginia, where the stars are bright. There aren't the bright city lights, and we can see billions of them. And the other night, I took two of my little granddaughters out on the porch, and we wrapped up in a blanket, and I showed them the Big Dipper up in the sky. And I told them this little story. I said, there had been no rain in the land for a very long time. All the flowers had withered and died. The grass was parched and brown. And all the creek beds and all the river beds were dry. The wells had no water in them. And all the birds and the dogs and the cats and the people were so thirsty. They were so uncomfortable and so sick. And one little girl had a mother, and her mother was very ill. And she thought, if I can just get some water for my mother, I know she'll feel better. And so she took a little tin cup and set out in search for water. And she walked and walked until she found a tiny little spring way up on the mountainside. And she held her little tin cup under the rock where the water dripped, dripped, dripped into the cup, slowly, slowly filling it up. And then finally, when the cup was full, she carefully held it in her hands and made her way down the mountainside to get it back to her mother. On the way, she came across a little dog who was so thirsty he could barely drag himself across the dirt. His tongue was hanging out and it was parched, and she thought, how can I leave this poor little dog without giving him something to drink? She said, if I give him just a little bit of water, I'll have enough for my mother. So she poured a little water in her hand and he licked it up, and he was happy and wagged his tail. And she didn't notice, but the tin cup that she was holding, the tin dipper, had turned into a silver dipper, and it had just as much water as it had before. Well, she hurried home to her mother. It was late in the afternoon, almost dark, and she ran up the stairs, and the old servant opened her mother's door. The old servant who had been caring for her mother all during the hot day. She could hardly speak because she was so tired and thirsty. And the mother said, oh, she needs the water more than I do. Give her to drink first. So the little girl gave the servant water to drink. And she didn't notice, but the silver dipper turned into a gold dipper, and it had just as much water in it as it did before. The mother took the cup to her lips, and she drank and drank until she wasn't thirsty anymore. And then she handed the cup to the little girl, and just as she put it to her lips to take a drink, there was a knock at the door. The servant opened it, and there stood a stranger, pale and dusty from long traveling. He said, oh, please, do you have some water for me to drink? And the little girl said, of course I do. You need it much more than I do. Here, you can drink it all. The man took the gold dipper from the little girl, and he smiled. But just as he touched it, the gold dipper turned into diamonds. And he turned it over, and as he did, all the water spilled out into the ground and soaked into the ground. And where the water soaked in, a fountain bubbled up, and water came, clean, fresh, cool water, enough water for all the people and all the animals to drink. And they were so busy drinking the water that they had forgotten about the old man, the stranger. And when they turned to look, he was gone. But some of them thought that they just saw him vanishing up in the sky. And there where they looked, shining clear and bright high in the sky, shone the diamond dipper. And it shines there still to remind people of the kind and unselfish little girl. And we call it the star dipper. Now I hope that my little granddaughters in the years to come will not only think about, when they look at that big dipper in the sky, will not only think about a kind and unselfish little girl, but they will remember how they felt when they heard that story. That above all, I hope they will remember that they have a grandma who loves them, and that no matter where they are in life, whatever happens, they can look up in the sky and recognize a jewel and feel that love. When we connect nature to feeling, they always have a jewel that they can turn to. We've been finding a lot of caterpillars around our neighborhood. And this is a favorite poem of mine in connection with a caterpillar. A twig where clung two soft cocoons I broke from a wayside spray and carried home to a quiet desk where long forgot it lay. One morn I chanced to lift the lid, and lo, as light as air, a moth flew up on downy wings and settled above my chair. A dainty, beautiful thing it was, orange and silvery gray, and I wondered how from the withered bough such fairy stole away. Had the other flown? I looked to see and found it striving still to free itself from the swathing floss and rove the air at will. Poor little prisoned waif, I said, you shall not struggle more. And tenderly I cut the thread and watched to see it soar. Alas, a feeble chrysalis, it dropped from its silken bed. My help had been the direst harm. The pretty moth was dead. I should have left it there to gain the strength that struggle brings. 'Tis stress and strain in moth and men that free the folded wings. If the trees and the flowers, the clouds and the wind all tell wonderful stories to the child, he has sources of happiness of which no power can deprive him. Music is also an important jewel to give our children. It reaches deep into our hearts. It was just 2 weeks past D-Day, just a few miles from Omaha Beach. German snipers had already taken out 28 engineers who were trying to carve an airstrip in the Normandy countryside. There was one lone sniper left off in the distant night. Captain Jack Tueller had been warned not to play his trumpet that night. It was just too dangerous. But as he sat and thought about this German sniper out there, he thought, I bet he's just as lonely and scared as I was. So Captain Jack leaned against an old apple tree and started to play old German love songs on his trumpet through the night. The next morning, the military police came driving into camp and said that they had a German prisoner in their camp, and he kept asking who was playing that trumpet. Jack grabbed his trumpet and drove down to the beach, and there he came face to face with a German dressed as a French peasant. It was the sniper. He said that when he heard the music, he burst into tears and knew he could no longer shoot because it made him think of his fiancée and his parents. And Jack said that he reached out and shook the hand of the enemy, but he said, we were not enemies. The music had made us friends. Music is pure emotion. It has a powerful effect on us. If we truly understood how powerful music is in our lives, we would probably be more careful about the kind of music we surround ourselves with. In ancient days, they understood the vibrational healing qualities of music, and it was used for healing. Later, music was used to drive the meaning of the scriptures deeper into the hearts to give a more spiritual experience. And then the music masters came along, and these wonderful geniuses broke the secret code so that they could express deep thoughts and deep feelings through music. What a wonderful breakthrough for the world. And then, well, this has been going around on Facebook. It's simply titled, Music, What Happened? First, it has Frank Sinatra. With each word, your tenderness grows, tearing my fear apart, and that laugh that wrinkles your nose, it touches my foolish heart. And then they posted Justin Bieber. And I was like, baby, 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 no. I'm like, baby, 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 no. I'm like, baby. Music, what happened? For sure. On a cold January morning, a man sat at a metro station in Washington, D.C. and started to play his violin. During the time it took to play six Bach pieces, it was estimated that thousands of people passed by him, mostly on their way to work. First, a middle-aged man slowed his pace just for a moment and then hurried by. A minute later, a woman threw a dollar in his case without stopping. He got the most attention by the children, but in every case, the adult dragged the child away so that they couldn't listen. In the 45 minutes that the musician played, only six people stopped to listen for a while. He collected a total of $32 from passerbys. When he finished, there were no applause, no recognition, just silence. No one knew it, but this was actually a social experiment put on by the Washington Post. The musician was Joshua Bell, one of the world's foremost musicians. He was playing one of the most intricate pieces ever written for the violin, and he was playing on a $3.5 million violin. Just a few days before, he had been at a sold-out concert where people paid over $100 a piece just to listen to him play this very same music. And yet people couldn't hear the music. They couldn't recognize the gift of beauty that it was. So the question becomes, how can we restore music as a jewel of life in the lives of our children? I think you're probably already doing one of the most important things, which is to play good music for them. If our children are raised on classic music that was unlocked by the music masters, they're not going to be satisfied with three chords and a beat. They are going to want something more. And if we tell them the stories of those great music masters, they will come to see the huge price that they paid, the sacrifices they made to learn music. But I think even more than that, simpler than that, I'm finding that that if you ask a child if they can sing, often they say no. And I'm wondering if that's because we are so connected to professional singers that we connect singing with somebody who can sing professionally. When you look at people, you know, from generations past, they sang while they worked, they sang while they played. Do we sing anymore? Is it because we don't know what to sing? Is, oh, baby, baby, no, not enough to sing? I don't know. But one suggestion, if there isn't singing going on in your world and in the lives of your children, a great place to start is with folk songs, because folk songs were written by ordinary people to be sung by ordinary people. They're fun to sing. And as they come to learn folk songs, they become connected with our heritage and what people felt in their hearts in the past. There was a story of Estonia. Maybe you have seen this. Estonia was under communist rule for over 50 years. And during that time, the people were forbidden to sing their folk songs. Now, they had been a very heritage-rich country. The folk songs were everything to them. Well, beginning in the 1980s, systematically and publicly for 5 years, people gathered together to sing their folk songs. And if you saw the movie Casablanca, do you remember the scene where the French sang La Marseillaise in defiance of the Germans? If you remember the power of that and then multiply it by 100,000 voices, that's what was going on in Estonia. And the result was that the communists could no longer hold power over these people who were singing. It was called the Singing Revolution. And the communists withdrew without a single drop of blood shed. Music is powerful. We can also give our kids the most comforting music ever written by teaching them hymns that they can sing by heart. A couple of my daughters had a couple of college classmates that married, and not long after they were married, the husband was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And at the funeral, the widow had requested that everyone sing a certain hymn. And she explained that in her husband's final days, he said that angels had come and had gathered around his bedside, and to comfort him, they had sung this hymn to him. I truly believe that hymns are one of those connecting links between heaven and earth. When you hear the stories behind the hymns, so many of them came as a gift to the composer that it literally wrote themselves. And as we give our children hymns to sing by heart, they will always have a source of comfort to draw from in the days ahead. Alice Hersomer, who is recently the oldest living Holocaust survivor, recently wrote a book in which she described how music had saved her life during the Holocaust. When her 72-year-old mother was led away to a concentration camp, as she left, she told her daughter, "Practice the Chopin etudes. They will save your life." So for the next year, this woman practiced her Chopin etudes. They were some of the most difficult pieces written for music, but she faithfully mastered them until a year later when she and her husband and her little boy were also deported to a concentration camp. How true her mother's words were. This is what Alice said. "Music gave heart to many of the prisoners. In retrospect, I am certain that it was the music that strengthened my innate optimism and saved my life and that of my son. It was our food, and it protected us from hate and literally nourished our souls. There in the darkest corners of the world, it removed our fears and reminded us of the beauties around us." Like music, great art has an effect on us that can't be put into words. I love this that my daughter sent to me. "The earth without art is just eh." We can't really explain why we're drawn to a particular painting. There's just something about it that speaks to our soul. We try and walk away, but we're drawn back to it. Some people can sit silently in front of a painting for hours, just soaking in the feelings that that painting conjures up. I don't know if you like my scarf or not, but what if I told you this? One of my daughters married a man from India, and when they went to India, they brought this home for me, and it's called chicken art, and this was made in a village where the people, their livelihood is to sit around and to do this beautiful chicken art. This is hundreds and maybe thousands of tiny little stitches that there's all the generations, the children, the parents, the grandparents, that they sit around and they do this intricate handwork on these scarves. I was wearing this a couple weeks ago at a conference, another conference I was doing, and a girl came running up to me and she said, "Oh, I love your scarf so much." And I told her what I told you about it, and she goes, "Oh my gosh, I love it 1,000 times more. That's what story can do to art. That's how we, in our world, our children are exposed to images all the time, but story is how we get them to feel things about the art that they're seeing. So what I would like to do, yesterday, if you were in my storytelling presentation, I talked about 4 different stages of development in children and stories that are applicable for each one. So I'd like to show 4 pieces of art pertaining to each of these age groups, starting with the youngest group. If you remember, the youngest ones, the 3 to 5 or 6-year-olds, they like familiar things. They like dogs and cats and horses and mommies and babies. And so this painting, The Lions at Home, might be a good one to show them. And this is painted by a French painter, Rosa Bonheur. This is an example of a story that you might tell a child. Rosa loved nothing more than to play out in the fields with the squirrels and the rabbits. She even had a little pet lamb. But one day, they had to leave the pet lamb behind and move into the city of Paris because her father was an artist, and he had to be around more people to sell his painting. She was so sad to leave behind her animals because the house they moved into didn't have any yard. And then an even sadder thing happened. Her mother died, and her family now had to move into an apartment that was up 6 flights of stairs. There was no place to have an animal. But her dad felt sorry for her and knew she missed it, so he bought them a sheep that they kept up in their apartment. And every afternoon when her brother came home from school, he picked up that big sheep and he walked down the 6 flights of stairs and tried to find a little grass for the sheep to nibble on. And then he carried the sheep back up 6 flights of stairs to their little apartment. Well, Rosa discovered that she liked to paint just like her dad. And she loved more than anything to paint animals. And as people started to buy her paintings, she got enough money that she was able to buy a house out in the country. And she had a garden. And out behind the garden, she had horses and deer and monkeys and every kind of animal that you can imagine. She wasn't afraid of any animal. She loved them all. She even made friends with lions. She always said, to have wild animals love you, you must first love them. So she had a great wild lion named Nero as a pet out behind her garden. And when she would walk out to his cage, he would walk over to her and he would let her pet his mane. And they got to be good friends. Well, she had to leave for a while. And so she had to take her pet Nero to the big zoological garden in Paris. He must have known something was going on because all the way he thrashed his tail against the cage, the bars in the cage, and roared all the way to Paris. When Rosa finally came home, Nero was blind and dying from homesickness. He missed her so much. So she took Nero home, and he died with his big mane in her lap. This painting is of Nero. Now, a child, that's a very sad story, but I promise you the next time even a little child looks at that painting, they're not going to just see lions. They're going to have feelings of compassion for animals. They're going to remember how much Rosa loved animals, and of even a ferocious beast responding to the power of love. The next age is the 5 to 8-year-olds. This is the time for imaginative stories. This is the time you're telling them fairy tales and introducing them to Greek myths. This is a famous painting by Jean-Baptiste Camille Corot about Orpheus and Eurydice. And maybe you will have told them the story of Orpheus. He's the one that could tame everyone with his music. And he loved Eurydice so much that when she died, he went down to the underworld and even charmed Hades into agreeing to let him take Eurydice back. It's a sad story, really, but that isn't the story I would necessarily tell while I'm showing this painting. But this is a story that you could tell. Camille was a boy who loved to be outdoors. He hated to come inside when the sun came down. Long after everyone else in his family had gone to sleep, he would sit for hours by the open window in his room, watching the silent moon travel across the skies. He would imagine the moon was a shepherdess and the fleecy white clouds were her sheep, and he would wonder if she could ever gather them safely together again. When all was quiet and still and all he could hear was the rustling of leaves, he would imagine they were telling secrets and that fairies were out in the woods having a party. They would come sailing across the pond in floating leaves to dance under the trees. The fireflies were their lanterns. It's no wonder he was always laughing and singing, for Camille was a very happy boy. He loved all of nature, especially the skies and the trees, and he was happiest when he took his paints outdoor and painted all the wonders he could see. Eventually, he moved to Paris, and as he grew older, he was called Father Corot. No one was more beloved. No one was more gentle and kind. No one was more ready to help anyone in trouble. He never turned away beggars. He freely gave words of advice and cheer while placing silver coins in their hands. He often thought about the prisoners and thought if the walls of the prisons were painted sky blue with clouds in the sky and trees lifting their branches heavenward, it would help them want to live better lives. In his final days, he was given a gold medal for his work. It brought tears to his eyes as he thanked them and said, "It makes me very happy to be loved so much." That was the last time he was seen in public. The beautiful paintings he left behind make us happy too. Now for the heroic periods, I actually picked the everyday hero. Jean-Francois Millet was a man of the everyday hero. He loved the French peasants. He loved their simple life and just a good, honest day work. And this is a painting of feeding her birds. And this may be a conversation or a dialogue that you could have with your children about this. In a tiny white cottage in a little village in France lived a painter with his wife and 9 children. This painter's name was Jean-Francois Millet, and although they were quite poor, his was a very happy family. Nearly every morning, the father worked hard in his garden behind the house. And every afternoon in the old room he called his studio. Here he painted beautiful pictures of places and people he saw and loved. Almost all of his pictures are of the country and of people who worked because he knew most about them and because he loved them best. Sometimes he finished his work in the garden very early, and then he was glad, for he liked better to paint than to do anything else in the world. One day when he looked out through the window of his studio, he saw a much prettier picture than the one he was painting. He saw 3 of his children sitting in a row on the doorstep, while the mother fed broth to each of them in turn from a wooden spoon. As they crowded together, they reminded him of some little birds he had been watching that morning. You know how little birds open their beaks and crowd toward the edge of the nest when the mother bird feeds him? Millet thought he would paint this picture, and he named it Feeding Her Birds. See how the mother tips forward on the stool as she bends toward the 3 children? They seem to be very hungry. They've probably been playing hard all morning. It's easy to see that the little girl at the left-hand side of the picture has been playing with her doll. She holds her wooden doll very close and loves it just as much as if it were made of china and had real hair. She is the eldest of the children and is unselfish because she sits patiently by while her baby brother and little sister get the first taste of the delicious broth. It looks like the boy and the younger girl have been playing with the basket and cart in the picture because the basket is overturned like it's been dropped in a hurry when the mother came to the door with the broth. See the hen running toward them? She thinks there must be something for her to eat, too. The man behind the house is working busily in the garden. Millet must have thought of himself when he painted this man, for, like the father bird, he must work hard to get enough food for his family. Sometimes there is very little, and the bread had to be divided into such tiny pieces that the children were still hungry when they had eaten their share. What a nice big yard these children had to play in, and what good times they must have had, playing all kinds of games. Notice everything in the picture is homemade. The clothes, the doll, the spoon, the cart, the basket, and even the milking stool the mother is sitting on. Sitting there in the bright sunlight, these happy little children will soon finish their broth, and they'll be ready to go back and play some more. Now, the thing about living in the age that we are is that you can print out these beautiful art prints and, you know, make a notebook, put them into plastic sheet protectors. So as you tell these stories to your children, they have a book, not just of ordinary images, but art that is speaking stories, speaking to their heart and reminding them of the things that you're teaching. And then I just think it's so remarkable that we can, for not a lot of money, get art reproduced, the great masterpieces. We can hang this art on the walls in our home. If you choose art that means something to your children, every time they walk by that painting, that is going to speak something to their soul. Imagine if we chose art that spoke to our children's hearts rather than just picking pictures to match our couches. Yes. These stories are actually drawn from on Internet Archives. There are wonderful books written for children before 1920. And if you go to Libraries of Hope, we are gathering a lot of these stories that we'll make available. But that's where I go and look because they told stories. You know, when I look at what they teach kids about art today, they often will focus on the mechanics first. You know, they'll teach about lighting or color or technique. And I don't find the stories. But back then, because they wanted them to feel it, they focused on these beautiful and wonderful stories. You know, if you want to come meet me at my booth, I'll see if I can find the reference for that particular one and make sure you get that one. The thing about Millais paintings is that they didn't sell very well in his day because the people that could afford to buy them were the rich people, and they wanted paintings of the rich and famous. They wanted women in jewels and furs. But the thing about this next painting, this is called the Angelus. The Angelus was a bell that would ring every night at sunset. And when Millais painted it, he sold it for $100. And the person that bought it took it on tour, and there was something about this painting that just touched hearts, that as people looked at this simple peasant life, it would just bring tears to their eyes. And shortly after Millais died, this same painting that he had sold for $100 sold for $100,000. There's something about it. This was a story that I found in connection with this that would be suitable for an older child, maybe 12 and older, for the message that it speaks. Every evening after sunset, when the most wonderful soft light is in the sky, and it is very still everywhere, the old bell in the steeple chimes out over the village and the fields around. No one quite knows what the bell sings, but the tone is so beautiful that everyone stands still and listens. Ever since the oldest grandfather can remember, the dear bell has sung at evening, and everyone has listened and listened for the message. A great many people said there was really no message at all, and one very learned man wrote a whole book to show that the song of the evening bell was nothing but the clanging of brass and iron, and almost everyone who read it believed it. But there were many who did not read it, so they listened to the sweet tone just as lovingly as they had listened when they were little children. Sometimes those who read the learned book spoke together and laughed quite loudly to show that they were not paying any attention to the bell, and there were others who seemed not to hear it at all. But there were some who listened, just as the old grandfathers had listened, and many who stopped and bowed their heads and stood quite still for a long, long while. But the strange thing was that no one could ever tell the other what the bell had sung to him. It was really a very deep mystery. Now there was a painter who had such loving eyes that even when he looked on homely, lowly things, he saw wonder that no one else could see. He loved all the sweet mysteries that are in the world, and he loved the bell's song. He wondered about it. One evening he went alone beyond the village and through the wide brown fields. He saw the light in the sky and the birds going home and the steeple far off. It was all very still and wonderful, and as he looked, he saw a man and a woman working together in the dim light. They were digging potatoes. There was a wheelbarrow beside them and a basket. Sometimes they moved about slowly or stooped down with their hands in the brown earth, and while they worked, the sound of the evening bell came faintly to them. When they heard it, they rose up. The mother folded her hands and said the words of a prayer and thought of her little ones. The father held his hat in his hand and looked down at their work, and the painter forgot all the wonder of the sky and the wide field as he looked at them, for the mystery was plain to him. As the man and the woman stood there listening, they did not know that the bell was singing to them of their very own work, of every loving service and lowly task of the day. The bell sang on, and the peace of the song seemed to fill the whole day. Can our children today still hear the singing of the bell? It is our privilege to do something that no other group of people has ever been able to do in the entire history of the world, because we have advantages no other people has ever had. For starters, we're not scrounging every day for food. We've got labor-saving devices. We have the luxury of time. But kings and queens of yesteryear, with all their wealth, could never in a lifetime view the masterpieces of art or listen to the masterpieces of music that the child in the most humble home has access to on the internet today. We can stream symphonies and beautiful music through our home all day. There was no playback button for those kings. They listened once and it was over. They couldn't get around to all of the castles where the art was, and yet we can just go on the internet and one after another we see the masterpieces. Nobility would have been envious of the library that is available to us for free on the internet. Think of the literature, the whole treasury of literature since the beginning of written history is free to us on the internet. All the wisdom of all the countries, all the cultures is brought together in this wonderful tool that we have free access to, and that we are a free people that we can study what we want. The one thing that is missing are eyes to see, ears to hear, and especially hearts to feel. Awakening a love of beauty in a new generation is the most important work we can do. And the Doctrine and Covenants, it says, for Zion must increase in beauty. Zion must arise and put on her beautiful garments. Because when there is a people who love beauty more than they love money, popularity, or pleasure, when beauty receives true love's first kiss, then there will be a new light shine upon the hill that the nations of the world, tired of the noxious briars and tangled weeds, will look to and seek to emulate. And the kingdom of God will gloriously spring to life, and beauty will cover the earth. And we will all live happily ever after. Thank you.
LDS Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.